now that I see who's here, well, it might be a little bit basic, but bear with me. And I think the best way for this to go is if you, I have many, many backup slides. So if you, if there's anything which you want to know more about, ask me and I can go into more detail because I'm going to cover everything at a rather basic level unless you ask me more detailed questions. So I want to start with a bit of a disclaimer because I think whenever someone like me is up in front of you talking about dark matter physics, there are two important facts that you should keep in mind, at least today. The first fact is we know a lot about dark matter, both on astrophysical and cosmological scales. The evidence for the existence of dark matter is completely overwhelming. But with that said, the second fact is we know almost nothing about dark matter. So what do I mean by this? I mean, we have no evidence for non-gravitational interactions of dark matter, both dark matter with the rest of the standard model and dark matter with itself. And we also have no evidence for any particular dark matter mass. And these are the questions we're trying to get at with our search for new physics in the dark sector. Just to drive this second point home, there are well-motivated dark matter models spanning over 20 orders of magnitude in dark matter mass. For example, at scales on the order of 100 GeV, we have weakly interacting massive particle or WIMP dark matter models. And then on the other end of the spectrum, at scales on the order of 10 to the minus 10 EV, we have axion dark matter models. And these are both well-motivated. In fact, I'll touch on both classes of models today during my talk. So I think it's a very exciting time right now in the search for new physics in the dark sector for a few reasons. One, the existence of dark matter points clearly to the existence of beyond the standard model physics. Two, we have many well-motivated dark matter models, but importantly, these models are testable experimentally. So combining these two points, I think it's rather likely in the relatively near future we'll begin to unveil the dark sector. And I think when this happens, this will give us a window into what lies beyond the standard model. So my talk today is going to consist roughly of two parts. In the first part of my talk, I'm going to focus on WIMP dark matter, in particular efforts to search for WIMP dark matter using indirect detection. And then I'll switch over, and in the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about axions. And in particular, I'm going to present a new idea for a detector capable of probing axion dark matter. So these two parts of my talk might seem somewhat disjoint, but it's important to remember that they're both trying to answer the same question, and that is, what is the underlying nature of the dark sector? Another reason I like these showing these two aspects is that I think they independently illustrate two themes which are very important today in our search for new physics in the dark sector. In the axion case, that theme is going to be there's a lot of progress we can make by thinking of new ideas that utilize advances in the precision frontier. And then in the WIMP side, the theme is going to be there's a lot we can learn already from existing data by thinking more carefully about how we analyze that data, in particular, thinking of ways to separate out a potentially dim signal from an often dominant and poorly understood background. So to be a little bit more specific about the first part of my talk, if I had to give a thesis for this part of my talk, it might be that populations of dim point sources are a very important source of background in searches for dark matter annihilation. And I'll be illustrating this throughout my talk with the gamma ray sky as seen by Fermi, although many of these points also apply to the high-energy neutrino sky as seen by Ice Cube. Just due to time, I'm not going to talk about Ice Cube unless you ask me more questions, and then I can talk about Ice Cube. So one very nice aspect of indirect detection is it naturally connects the signal that we look for today with our detectors with the production mechanism which sets the abundance of dark matter in the early universe in a broad class of models. And the intuition here is that at early times, at high temperatures, dark matter is in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the standard model. As the universe expands and cools down at some temperature, dark matter falls out of equilibrium. That temperature is set by this annihilation rate. And this sets the abundance of dark matter, which gives us structure we see in the CMB, which evolves into galaxies and clusters of galaxies that we see today. If we concentrate on one of these galaxies today, this galaxy is surrounded by a dark matter halo. Dark matter annihilation can still occur in this halo, giving us cosmic rays which can stream into our detector. And today I'll be concentrating for most of my talk on Fermi, which sees gamma rays. Now, after Fermi launched in 2008, something very exciting happened in this field. An excess of gamma rays was observed around the galactic center, consistent with arising from dark matter annihilation. So here you're seeing a full sky map as seen by Fermi. The galactic plane cuts clearly across the middle of this image. The galactic center is directly in the middle. Most of the emission that you see here comes from standard astrophysical processes such as inverse Compton and Bremsstrahlung emission. Also pion decay is important. But if you focus in on the galactic center region and you subtract off the predicted contributions from these other astrophysical sources, you find this residual shown here, this significant residual. Now here are some facts about this so-called galactic center excess. The XS is very spherically symmetric, which is consistent with our expectations from dark matter annihilation. Spatial profile is consistent with expectations from dark matter annihilation. The energy spectrum is very hard, peaking around 2 GeV. This is consistent with many dark matter models, inconsistent with expectations from most astrophysical backgrounds. And this is quite robust. The evidence for this excess is quite robust. This is perhaps the most important point against mismodeling cosmic ray-induced emission. So taken together, this could sound like quite strong evidence for a new physics. But I think it's important to remember the implications of finding non-gravitational interactions in the dark sector. If this is really what we're seeing, this would have huge implications. So I think it's very important to be cautious, especially because the galactic center is a very messy environment and there are potential astrophysical backgrounds. And today in my talk, I'll try to convince you that one particularly relevant source of background could be a population of dim point sources centered around the galactic center. By dim, I mean so dim that they cannot be detected individually. And these could be generating this galactic center excess. And one particularly relevant source of point sources could be millisecond pulsars, one of which is illustrated here. So in the beginning of my talk, I'm going to present a new method called the non-Poissonian template fit, which can try to distinguish between these two hypotheses. On the one hand, the hypothesis that we're seeing dark matter annihilation. On the other hand, the hypothesis that we're seeing emission from a population of dim point sources. And then I'll apply that analysis to the data to show evidence that, in fact, what we're seeing is emission from dim point sources and, unfortunately, not dark matter annihilation. So here's an outline for the remainder of my talk. I'll begin by introducing this method, the non-Poissonian template fit. I'll then apply it to the data to show evidence for gamma ray point sources around the galactic center. And I'll discuss some ongoing efforts to actually identify these point sources in other wavelengths. And then I'll switch gears in the last part of my talk. I'll tell you about my new idea for searching for axion dark matter. So let me begin now with a non-Poissonian template fit. So here I've generated a galactic center excess under two assumptions. On the left-hand side, I'm assuming that what we're seeing is emission from dark matter annihilation. On the right-hand side, I'm assuming what we're seeing is emission from a population of dim point sources, here not so dim. And here I'm showing you the excess only without any diffuse background in order to make this comparison easier by eye. So obviously, right now, you don't need any sophisticated algorithm to differentiate between these two hypotheses. But I want to try to gain some intuition from these images so we can develop an algorithm that we can put on a computer in order to differentiate between these images when it's not so easy to do so by eye. So with that in mind, let's concentrate on some small regions of these images and try to be quantitative about the differences. In the dark matter case, within this box, you can see that all pixels, notice I pixelated the sky, all pixels see roughly the same number of photon counts, with fluctuations just being Poissonian. In the point source case, that's no longer the case anymore, because I have lucky pixels, which happen to sit directly on top of point sources, which see a large number of photon counts. And I have unlucky pixels, which sit far away from point sources, which see very few photons, because roughly speaking, the total number of photon counts should be the same between these two images. But the distribution of photon counts is different. And I want to describe to you now an algorithm which takes advantage of this difference in photon count statistics in order to try to differentiate between these two hypotheses. So a key ingredient in this algorithm is going to be the ability to calculate the probability of finding k photons in a given pixel p. If I have smooth emission, for example, emission coming from dark matter annihilation, then my photon counting statistics are Poissonian. So if in a given pixel p, the mean expected number of photon counts is lambda, then the probability of seeing k photons is given by the Poisson distribution with mean lambda. But when I have unresolved point sources, so I have point sources and I don't know where they are, then my photon counting statistics become non-Poissonian. And this is for a very simple reason. Essentially, now I have to ask two questions. The first question is, in a given pixel, what is the probability of finding a point source or a point source near that pixel? And then the second question is, given that point source, what is the probability it produces k photons? And to some extent, to answer each one of these questions, I have to draw from a Poisson distribution. So it shouldn't be too surprising that at the end of the day, the total photon count statistics I end up with are non-Poissonian. To answer this first question, I need to know something about the point source population. I'm going to parameterize the point source population by a source count function, dndf, rapid flux in units of photons per centimeter squared per second. Dn here in a given pixel p has the interpretation of being the mean expected number of point sources, which on average contribute flux between f and f plus df. So I'm going to parameterize my source count function as a broken power law with a break fb in flux, an index n1 above the break, n2 below the break, an overall normalization a of p, and a of p is going to be allowed to follow a spatial template. So if I'm looking for isotropically distributed point sources, then A of P will be constant among all pixels. But if instead I'm looking for a population of point sources which mimics this galactic center axis, then A of P will follow a spherical template centered around the galactic center. Does this make sense? Are there any questions here?
So I guess my question is, why do you assume that it must be a spherical, either of those?
So for this A of P, I could in principle allow this to follow any template. Suppose I was, well, I'll show you the templates I'm going to consider. I'll also consider point sources following the disk. But here, in particularly, I'm looking for a population of point sources which mimics this galactic center axis. And we know from observation this galactic center axis is spherical. So because I want to explain the data, I'm going to assume that my population of point sources is spherical.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, must be something that you should allow as a pre-parameter.
That's right. And I've already done that. So I performed, normal Poissonian template fits, where I allow the axis ratio and the alignment of this profile to vary. And you find that it's very spherical. The best fit value is spherical. So I actually have another paper which is coming out next week, which makes this even more precise, but it's extremely spherical. So the axis goes out to around 10 degrees,
okay.
Uncontroversially. Controversially, maybe a bit farther. Yeah. So at this point, I'm going to write down a likelihood function. My data set consists of some number of counts np in each pixel because I'm summing over energy. I'm only considering a single energy bin. My model has a variety of parameters, including the parameters of my source count function and perhaps parameters for the Poissonian templates I might have around. Then my likelihood function is simply the product over pixels of these probabilities. So if I don't have unresolved point sources, if I just have smooth emission, these probabilities are Poissonian, and the likelihood function reduces to that of a standard astrophysical template fit. And these are very commonly used in astrophysics. But when I have unresolved point sources, then my probabilities become non-Poissonian, and I get the likelihood function of what I'm calling a non-Poissonian template fit. So at this point, I'm just going to use standard Bayesian techniques to scan over this likelihood function and construct a posterior distribution for my model parameters data. So now I just want to apply this to the galactic center axis. But before I do so, let me just say a few more words about these two interpretations that we have for the galactic center axis. On the one hand, we have the interpretation that we're seeing emission from dark matter. On the other, point sources. Let me start with dark matter. So it turns out the galactic center axis is very well fit by dark matter annihilating into the standard model. But importantly, you don't annihilate directly into gamma rays. You annihilate into something else, such as BB bar, which then cascade down, losing energy, creating a broad spectrum of gamma rays. And the reason is this axis is quite broad. It's not a very narrow resonance. The mass that you need varies between roughly 10 to 100 GeV, depending on the channel. But really, I think the interesting thing is the annihilation cross-section that you need in order to explain the normalization that we see for the galactic center axis. You need an annihilation cross-section right around 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second. And this is a very interesting number. And if you don't know why it's interesting, I'll explain it to you now. So it turns out with this annihilation cross-section, you get the correct abundance of dark matter in the standard thermal scenario. So remember this picture where at early times, high temperatures, dark matter is in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the standard model. As the universe expands and cools down at some temperature, dark matter falls out of thermal equilibrium. And this temperature sets the abundance of dark matter. But this temperature is in turn determined by this annihilation cross-section for dark matter to convert into the standard model. So we know the observed abundance of dark matter, and we know how to relate this abundance to the annihilation cross-section. In order to get the observed abundance, we need an annihilation cross-section right around 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second. And I think this is really the reason that people have taken the dark matter interpretation of this galactic center axis so seriously, because this is the same number that we saw appearing on the previous slide. This is the reason I've taken the dark matter interpretation so seriously personally. And in some sense, I think if what we're seeing here is not dark matter annihilation, then nature will have played a very dirty trick on us, giving us this cross-section out for our best fit value. So I think the case for dark matter is quite strong. But I feel like I can make an equally strong case for millisecond pulsars, and I want to make that case to you now. So why millisecond pulsars? One, the energy spectrum of millisecond pulsars, observationally, is very close to the energy spectrum that we observe for the galactic center axis. So here on the y-axis, we have the spectrum E squared dNdE as the function of energy on the x-axis. In black are data points measured for the spectrum of the galactic center axis by one group. And then blue is the energy spectrum of a stacked sample of millisecond pulsars, appropriately normalized. And you can see that the two spectra are very similar. Perhaps there's some difference at low energies, but keep in mind the black points, the galactic center points, only include statistical uncertainties, not systematics. Systematics are known to be very important, and they're particularly relevant at low energies. So within systematic uncertainties, I would say there's no discrepancy between the millisecond pulsar spectrum.
What systematics are you thinking about?
Well, the main systematic, which affects, there are a few important systematics, and they're all roughly of equal magnitude. One is modeling diffuse emission. So this is when we do a standard template fit to extract the spectrum for the galactic center excess. So depending on what diffuse model you use, for Pion, Inverse Compton, and Bremsstrahlung, you'll get a different normalization for the galactic center excess, which makes sense. If you over-subtract a bit, then you'll get less, you'll get less flux going into your galactic center template. Another systematic is how you treat known point sources. So Fermi's instrument response function becomes worse and worse and worse as you go to lower and lower energies. And this should be the intuition why systematics become worse, because then you spread out the effects of mismodeling over larger scales. And so if you have even if you're mismodeling one point source, that can have an influence over large scales, which makes that systematic more important. So the two energy spectra are very similar. We can take this as a hint. The millisecond pulsars might have something to do with this excess. There are also arguments explaining why such a population should exist in the first place with the correct spatial distribution to explain the observed morphology of the galactic center excess. And I don't have time to go into all of those arguments now. You can ask me about them afterwards, though, or later if you want to know more about these arguments. But just keep in mind there are arguments explaining why such a population of millisecond pulsars would exist. So the millisecond pulsar argument, I think, is also quite strong. So the approach I want to take to this is to be as model-independent as possible and simply ask the data, using the non-Poissonian template fit, what do you prefer? Do you prefer millisecond pulsars or point sources, or do you prefer dark matter annihilation? So that's what I want to show you now. So I'm going to use new PASSE data. This is data through this past summer. This is an ultra-clean veto class of data.
Is that what Fermi uses now? They normally use clean.
It depends on the analysis. So for this ultra-clean veto, this is the best sample of events. Top quartile by PSF means the events with the best angular resolution. So these are the nicest photons that Fermi has. For my analysis, angular resolution is very important. So I'm using this top quartile by PSF. And I know by Monte Carlo that this is the optimal data set that I should use for this particular analysis. When I do other analyses on Fermi data, I do this process of saying, what am I looking for? I do Monte Carlo and I ask, what data set should I be using? And you get a different data set depending on the analysis. But for this analysis, this is the best data set. But you see similar results in other data sets. And I'm going to use a single energy bend between roughly 2 to 12 GeV because this is where the galactic center peaks. Here are the Poissonian templates that I'll include. In red, I'm showing the number of model parameters. For each one of these templates, the model parameter is simply the overall normalization of this template. So I have a template for diffuse emission, a template for the Fermi bubbles, isotropic emission, and dark matter emission, where dark matter now, remember the galactic center is directly in the middle. So if you're confused about isotropic, because it doesn't look isotropic, that's because this is a counts map. So flux map is isotropic, but the exposure map is anisotropic, because Fermi doesn't look at each part of the sky for an equal amount of time. So you're just seeing here where Fermi looks.
They don't have a diffuse model from PASSE.
There is a PASSE diffuse model. The PASSE diffuse model. Okay, so there's a PASS7 diffuse model and a PASSE diffuse model. And I can show you results with both of these diffuse models, but actually it turns out to be better to use the P6 diffuse model, although the results are similar. And the reason is this diffuse model is really kind of simulation motivated, Galprop motivated. The P7 and P8 diffuse models are really data driven, and they actually absorb large scale residuals into their models because they're meant to look for individual point sources. And so the galactic center excess is partially absorbed in P7 and P8 diffuse model.
So can I ask, so the Fermi bubble, I'm just wondering, how do we know what is bubble and what's not? I mean, does it just come from Fermi itself?
Yeah, this is just a phenomenological template for where we see the Fermi bubbles in the data. There's no theoretical argument. It's just something which is observed. No one really understands the Fermi bubbles. But this is another source of systematic. What if I were to get these Fermi bubbles wrong? And so I can show you systematic tests of this. I think the most convincing is just to completely remove the Fermi bubbles and the results don't change. And the reason is that the region I'm interested in is right around the galactic center, where the Fermi bubbles are barely contributing any flux in the first place. But for consistency, I include them in the analysis. Here are the non-Poissonian templates that I'll include. I'll include up to 3 isotropically distributed point sources, spherical point sources centered around the galactic center, and disk-correlated point sources, where the disk follows this double exponential distribution. Now my 4 model parameters are the parameters of my source comp function, that break, FB, the 2 indices, N1 and N2, and an overall normalization.
So why are you using NFW for point sources? So
this notation is a bit confusing. So by NFW, I mean that the spatial distribution of point sources follows what the dark matter annihilation profile should look like. So this doesn't mean NFW distributed point sources. This really means point sources distributed like the line of sight integral of NFW squared, which roughly corresponds to just a power law falloff as you go away from the galactic center. And that's because this is what's observed in the data.
What power? When you say power law?
So 1 over r to the 2 gamma, where gamma is 1.25, roughly.
1 over r to gamma, where gamma is?
1.25.
I mean, just thinking, maybe you could get the distribution of a star or something like that, because maybe you say the millisecond half stars follow the stellar distribution. So that would give you something.
Yeah.
Is it similar to what you
call? So for example, okay, let me just briefly explain one of these models for the millisecond pulsars. So I think the most convincing model for why these millisecond pulsars are there is that they come from merging globular clusters, which are tidally disrupted as they approach the center of the Milky Way. And in this model, you can do simulations and you can calculate what's the expected fall off with distance from the galactic center. And it is exactly what we're assuming here. And I can show you a plot of that afterwards. So I performed many, many cross-checks of this analysis, and I don't have time to go through all of them, but I want to start with one, because I think it's a very nice sideband study. In this energy range, if you scan along the galactic plane, the galactic center axis is not the only significant residual that you find. The next most significant residual is at L equals 30 along the galactic plane. We don't expect this L equals 30 axis to have anything to do with dark matter or anything to do with point sources. Instead, what we believe is going on is it's a local supernova remnant along the line of sight at L equals 30, spilling out cosmic rays, which are causing gamma ray emission. But importantly, this emission should be smooth. It should not be point source-like. So if I apply the non-Poissonian template fit to L equals 30, treating it as if it was the galactic center, and I find evidence for point sources centered around L equals 30, that would indicate, or might indicate, some intrinsic bias in my analysis, making this a very good sideband study. So here's the region I'm going to consider. This is the galactic plane. Positive L actually moves to the left. So I'm going to focus on this region. In particular, I'm going to extend out 30 degrees away from L equals 30 along the galactic plane, masking 4 degrees around the galactic plane. And just a technicality, but all plots will be normalized to a slightly smaller region, which only extends out to 10 degrees away from the center. So just to stress the point, I'm going to put down a dark matter template, and I'm going to put down a point source template. But these templates are centered around L equals 30, not around L equals 0. So I'm treating L equals 30 as if it was the galactic center. However, my disk template will still be centered around the galactic center. These are the main plots of this analysis. Let me explain things slowly. Let's start with the inset plot. On the y-axis, we have the posterior probability as a function of the fraction of flux on the x-axis. So in green, I'm showing you the posterior probability for isotropically distributed point sources. And the way you should read this is that isotropically distributed point sources like to absorb around 1% of the flux within this region. And blue is the posterior for disk-correlated point sources. Disk-correlated point sources like to absorb around 5% of the flux. And as advertised, my dark matter template, centered around L equals 30, absorbs a sizable fraction of the flux, around 5%. Now let's go to the outer plot. For the outer plot, I include all templates, but I also include my spherical point source template. My spherical point source template was not included here, but it is included here. And the posterior for this template is shown in orange, and you can see it's consistent with 0. So the way you should be reading this plot is that adding in spherical point sources does not help my fit, because all of the excess is still being absorbed by dark matter shown in red. None is being absorbed by spherical point sources, whose posterior is consistent with 0. I can be quantitative about this by calculating the Bayes factor and preference for the model with spherical point sources over that without. And the Bayes factor is 0.1, indicating there's no evidence for spherical point sources centered around L equals 30. Which makes sense because we didn't expect this population to exist. So all I'm going to do next is shift this region over to the galactic center, repeat the analysis. So before I do that, Are there any questions about this plot? Because it's very important to understand this plot. Okay.
So what is making up the, so there's, it's...
Why are things not adding to 100?
Yes.
Because I'm not showing you diffuse emission, for example, which makes up most of the flux. So I'm only showing you a few of these templates, but if you add everything up, it does get to 100. There's stuff over here. So now let's just shift this region over to the galactic center and repeat the analysis. So the plots here now have the same interpretation, but we see something qualitatively different than what we found at L equals 30. So let's start with the inset. When I don't include spherical point sources, I find around 7% of the flux within this region is absorbed by dark matter. That's consistent with what other groups have found. But now when I go to the outer plot, when I include spherical point sources, my spherical point source template absorbs the entire excess, and the dark matter normalization is consistent with zero. So now we see something qualitatively different. Now it looks like including spherical point sources is really helping out our fit. And now when I calculate the Bayes factor and preference for the model with spherical point sources over that without, I find a Bayes factor of around 10 to the 9. This is very strong evidence in favor of spherical point sources. I can attempt to convert this into sigma if people aren't used to Bayes factors, but this would be roughly 6 sigma evidence, depending on how you count for point sources. I'm not gonna be able to do this in real time. So the rough, I think you take the 2 times the log of the Bayes factor should correspond to a test statistic. Okay. And then you wanna take the square root of that to get to sigma.
Okay.
So it's what that gets to. But you shouldn't really do that because that's just a very rough mapping. I have done this all within the frequentist framework, and then you can actually extract the test statistic accurately, but I don't remember what it was for the 3FGL mass case. So there are 2 different numbers here. The 10 to the 4 Bayes factor comes if I mask all known gamma ray emitting point sources. So this is just some terminology, but Fermi's point source catalog is called the 3FGL catalog. So I mask every source in the 3FGL catalog. That significantly reduces my region, but I still find a very strong Bayes factor around 10 to the 4 in favor of the model with spherical point sources. And that 10 to the 4 is consistent with expectations from Monte Carlo, given the 10 to the 9 with the full region.
How does this change when you use something like a master profile instead?
Like a what profile?
Like an I master profile for the dark matter?
Oh, so I don't know. I don't know, but I imagine it doesn't change much. So roughly speaking, everything within the region I'm talking about, the profile just looks like a power law, because I'm not actually getting that close to the galactic center. So everything looks like a power law. So what I have done is varied the index of that power law, and the Bayes factor changes by maybe an order of magnitude or so. That is, there isn't very strong. So gamma, the best fit index, so the profile is falling off like 1/r^2 gamma. The best fit for gamma is around 1.25. But the change in the Bayes factor, the change in the test statistic, isn't very strong as you vary that gamma a little bit. So as you go from like 1.1 to 1.4 in gamma, you might find a change in the Bayes factor of an order of magnitude in either direction. And that's just because we're looking pretty far away from the galactic center.
Sorry, something stupid. So what if dark matter had substructure?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the standard scenario, it wouldn't look like this. So why wouldn't it look like that? Well, in the standard scenario, there is substructure, and substructure is very important far away from the galactic center. But then substructure becomes decreasingly important as you move towards the galactic center, because substructure tends to be tidally disrupted, and the bulk density is rising. Moreover, this is dark matter annihilation, so we're looking at dark matter density squared. Now, the substructure should give a signal which scales like dark matter density, not dark matter density squared. You have to square the density within the substructure, but the substructure itself scales like dark matter density. And it actually scales worse than that because of tidal disruption. So the profile would not go like 1/r^2 gamma. It'll go over like 1/r^gamma or even worse. And then the standard picture, we just don't expect substructure to be important here. So you need to think of a scenario where you somehow end up with dark matter substructure going like 1/r, like going like the dark matter density squared. And I don't know of such a scenario.
So my question is, if instead of a spherical distribution, you have, I guess, elliptical distribution.
Yeah.
Does this change?
Yeah, so remember that these disk point sources are essentially elliptical.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a profile which is extended along the plane of the Milky Way. And let me show you what happens on the next slide, actually, because that sheds some light onto this. So let me explain this plot, then I'll answer your question. So here I'm showing you another slice of the posterior distribution. This is the source count function. So on the y-axis, I have the source count function, dndf, as a function of flux, f on the x-axis. The black points here come from histogramming the 3FTL catalog within this energy range and within this region. So this tells you how many point sources there are which are detected in each flux bin. And the way you should look at this plot is that at this bin with 9 sources and above, you can have pretty high confidence that this histogram is complete. But starting at this bin with 18 sources and below, this is where Fermi's point source detection threshold starts to kick in, and these point sources are just too dim to detect the full population. So we expect at the bin with 18 sources and below for this histogram to be incomplete. In blue, I'm showing you the 68% confidence interval constructed from point-wise from the posterior distribution for the source count function for discorrelated point sources. And you can see the discorrelated point sources do a good job of explaining the high flux 3FTL sources. Then as we go to lower flux, we see a subdominant contribution from isotropically distributed point sources. This also matches the expectations. And then at very low flux, we see this new population of spherical point sources. So now let me get back to your question. You can see that the more elliptical population of point sources does a good job of explaining the high flux sources. But as you go to lower and lower flux, the distribution of point sources seems to be more and more spherical. That's what we seem to find with the data.
So which of these are measurements and which of these are things that you extracted from your
bit? Yeah, so they're all measurements in some sense, but they're different measurements. Yeah. So the black points are just histogramming the 3FTL catalog. So it's just a catalog of point sources. Most of these are actually unassociated. So it's known that there's a gamma ray pulsar there, or sorry, gamma ray point source there, but no one knows what it is.
Sure.
Some of these are associated. Some of them are pulsars, some of them are supernova remnants, and so forth. So that's just the catalog. Everything else comes from my fit. All of the bands and all the lines to the bands are just, this is a slice of the posterior distribution that I get from the fit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the black points here are just there to guide your eye, in some sense. The black points don't enter into the analysis. I just put them on this plot so that you can see that we do a good job of explaining the observed point sources at high flux.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so these are all still high. Well, my question is, if you add up all of these point sources that are in the black, then that does not give you enough to explain the...
No, it does not.
Okay.
It does not. The way you should be looking at this is if we add up blue plus green plus orange, this should equal the black points until this bin with 18 sources, and then these histograms are incomplete, and so we expect if we had perfect resolution, then this black histogram would continue upwards. So here, everything added together should equal these bins. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Do you have some kind of goodness of fit test for how well your model is doing, like whether it's fitting them up with data well with residuals?
Yes. We do, but I think really the best, and you can look at the absolute Bayesian evidence, or you can look at just the value of the likelihood function, for example. But I think in this business, it's better to look at differences, because it's better to look at a difference between some sort of test statistic or some Bayesian evidence versus two models to see how you're improving the model. None of the models do that great. I can tell you that. And it's because there are always regions, we're certainly not at the level of describing the sky at the level of Poissonian noise. When you look at the residual maps, and I have some here that I can show you, you see large scale residuals all over the place. You see, like the one at L equals 30 that I mentioned before, you see deficits as well. So we're certainly not at the level of describing the full sky at
Even
this region. So this is a pretty big region. This is a 30-degree region. There's a lot that happens there. But when you do zoom in on the residual close to the galactic center, you can see that this excess is very centered around the galactic center. It's different. It's qualitatively different from these other residuals that you see in deficits.
It's a subtle thing. But it's not about that you don't have residuals. It's just that your residuals are not Poissonian, right? That's the point.
Yeah, yeah. So this residual, yeah, that's what the point I was trying to make before. This residual is fundamentally different from all of the other residuals in that the statistics of it seem to be non-Platonium. So for most of these residuals...
It's not a residual once you fit your model. Right?
Sorry?
Once you fit your model, it's not a residual.
Yeah, it's not, well, it's hard to make a residual here because the statistics are non-Platonian, so I can't just subtract off the mean. But yeah, there seems to be a fundamental difference between this axis and the others. So for most of these other residuals, I would assume it's standard cosmic ray mismodeling, such as something which is causing some cosmic ray outflow, for example, that we don't have taken into account. So there are many questions that you can ask at this point, and I think maybe the most important question to ask, or the most interesting, is this information consistent with known information about millisecond pulsars if we want to try to interpret this excess as evidence for a new population of millisecond pulsars? So to try to answer this question, what I've done, and this exercise is difficult and subject to large uncertainties, is I've taken the brightest known millisecond pulsar seen by Fermi, and by brightest I mean the millisecond pulsar with the brightest intrinsic luminosity function, and I've asked, what would the flux be if I place the source at the galactic center? And I find the flux should fall within this purple band. That is, all known Fermi MSPs would have a flux less than that purple band. And you see an interesting coincidence of scales, because this purple band overlaps with this bin with 18 sources, which is where the point source detection threshold kicks in. And it also overlaps with right where we find this new population, the break in this new population of spherical point sources, which you could take potentially as evidence that there is a new population of millisecond pulsars in the galactic center directly below the current point source detection threshold for the detector. So with that in mind, I think the most interesting and important question to do at this point is to look at the sky and some other wavelength and try to find these millisecond pulsars. That is, where are these point sources and what are they? So to do this, I think we really need to go beyond gamma rays. There's only so much information we can get from gamma rays. And I've been looking recently into going into radio, and just this, past month, a little over a month ago now, I submitted, along with my collaborators, a Fermi GI proposal for radio time on the Green Bank Telescope to try to look at the locations of the sky where we find there should be point sources associated with this excess, to look at these locations in radio to try to find millisecond pulsars. So we're asking for around 100 hours of observing time. Preliminary feedback seems to indicate we'll actually get this observing time. And with this observing time, we could find around half a dozen new millisecond pulsars in the bulge within the next year if this MSP interpretation of the galactic center excess is correct. So finding these MSPs would have, I think, very important implications. One, this would be very convincing evidence that galactic center excess is coming from millisecond pulsars. Two, these millisecond pulsars could indicate some interesting new story in the formation of the Milky Way. And three, millisecond pulsars are always useful to have. For example, for gravitational wave searches using pulsar timing, you want millisecond pulsars. So I think there's a lot of excitement over possibly finding these millisecond pulsars. This would also be the farthest away MSPs ever seen which aren't in globular clusters, which would be interesting in and of itself. So before getting any detailed questions about these telescopes, I should say I'm not a radio astronomer, and I recognize this. So I sought out recently some expert radio astronomers, such as Paul Ray, and now we have a collaboration which consists of some expert radio astronomers who spend their time looking for MSPs in radio, theorists like myself and members of the Fermi collaboration. So this is something to keep your kind of ears tuned to over the next year. Hopefully we'll have some interesting results. So before I...
Fermi's not gonna be better at finding the lower luminosity guys.
Fermi will. So Fermi's gonna integrate down, and we have more sophisticated ways that we're developing to try to analyze that data, but there's only so much information you can get out of Fermi. For example, you can never really be... it's hard to see a millisecond pulsar with Fermi and gamma rays. It's hard to discriminate that scenario from some other point source scenario. And so I think you really need to go to another wavelength, and radio seems to be the most promising.
So you could hope to distinguish it from dark matter, but not show that it's similar.
Yeah, exactly. So before continuing on, I want to have a brief advertisement for the code package that I wrote to do this non-Platonian template fit. It turns out to be rather non-trivial to code up this Nambusonian template fit, so I do plan on releasing the code that I wrote for this analysis, likely within the next year. Key ingredients in this code are fast and semi-analytic evaluations of the probabilities and the likelihood function. The code can handle any instrument response function beyond Fermi's, a variety of source count function characterizations, beyond the simple broken power law, an arbitrary number of point source templates. The main interface is Python, although the code is written in C++. And the code can handle both Bayesian and frequentist options for scanning over the likelihood function. And there are a variety of applications beyond Fermi. It's a very general framework. For example, I'm currently applying within the IceCube collaboration this code package to IceCube data to look for high energy neutrino point sources. And recently, I've been getting some help from a few grad students, Lena and Nick at MIT and Siddharth at Princeton, who are now using this on a variety of related projects and who are also helping me get this ready for release, and they'll also be involved in maintaining this once it goes live.
Have you found any IceCube point sources?
I probably shouldn't say too much about that analysis, since it's going on within the collaboration.
You
and
told us to ask about it.
Yeah, I did. Interesting things are happening, but we need to understand a lot of systematics better. So I can tell you more about what we're trying to achieve, but I probably shouldn't say too much about the actual details of what we've found, mostly because it's very preliminary.
Okay.
So I kind of dodged that question. And
so you told us to ask it so that
I know, yeah. But I can tell you more if we have time about what we're trying to achieve with that program. So now I'm going to switch gears, because we're making a lot of progress in the search for WIMP dark matter. I've showed you indirect detection, but there's a lot of progress happening in indirect detection, in direct detection, and in collider searches for WIMP dark matter. And so I think it's very likely that we will find WIMP dark matter in the relatively near future. On the other hand, it's also a logical possibility we won't find WIMP dark matter, and we'll begin to disfavor that paradigm. And I think if that's the case, and it already is to some extent, it's going to be increasingly important to think about non-WIMP dark matter scenarios, and I think axion dark matter scenarios are very well motivated. So now I want to switch gears and talk about axions. So first I should tell you a little bit about what axions are and why we should care about them. So this will be review to most of you probably, but let me still go through this. So why do we think about axions? We think about axions, they're originally proposed to solve the strong CP problem. So the strong CP problem is related to these CP violating terms, which could have appeared in the QCD Lagrangian. There are two types of terms, one involving the QCD field strength, the other involving the quark fields. And you can convince yourself by performing a chiral rotation of the quark fields, which is anomalous. There's only one invariant combination, only one physical combination of these parameters, which I'm calling theta bar. The experimental implication of a non-zero theta bar is a neutron electric dipole moment. And despite a significant amount of experimental effort, no neutron electric dipole moment has been observed. And this can be used to set a constraint on this theta bar parameter. And the current constraint is that this value is somewhere less than around 10 to the minus 10. Now, theta bar you should think of as some angle which naively would have a value order 1. So it looks like we have to tune this parameter to 1 part in 10 to the 10. Now, this isn't the first time which tuning has appeared in physics, but I think the strong CP problem is fundamentally different. Because even in principle, I don't know of any anthropic argument for why theta bar is so small. That if theta bar was order 1 instead of 10 to the minus 10, our universe wouldn't look that different to how it looks today. And I think this really motivates finding some dynamical mechanism which dynamically removes these CP violating terms from the QCD Lagrangian. And the axion is such a dynamical mechanism. See, axion is a scalar field. And this field enters into the standard model by multiplying this operator. Now, this is now a dimension 5 operator. And so this scalar field needs to be divided by some mass scale. And this mass scale is going to be the so-called axion decay constant, FA. You should keep in mind that this is some rather large scale. Now, A, you should also think of as being some pseudo-Goldstone boson, which would be exactly massless. So it's a Goldstone boson of some symmetry, which is broken at this scale, FA. And it would be exactly massless, except for non-perturbative QCD effects, which generate a potential for this axion for the scalar field at low energies. Now, when the axion minimizes this potential, it dynamically removes these CP violating terms from the QCD Lagrangian. But in the process, it acquires some small mass, And this mass is inversely proportional to this decay constant. So if I take a decay constant at the gut skeleton, the 16 GeV, I end up with a mass on the order of 10 to the minus 9 EV. Another very important aspect of the axion, the most important for my talk, is that axion is also generically coupled to QED through a term proportional to AFF tilde, where F is now the QED field strength. This is again dimension 5, so I have a dimension full operator, GA gamma gamma, which is inversely proportional to FA, although there's some model dependence which enters into the numerator.
So I guess my question, why do they have to couple to electric field?
So generically, you couple to the electric field, and you don't have to. But generically, you do, because when you have this coupling to GG tilde, let's think of what we would do at low energies in order to understand this theory. We'd probably perform a Kawa rotation of the quark fields in order to remove this term and to instead bring it to the quark mass matrix, and then we can use standard perturbation theory for nucleons in order to understand the implications. That's the standard way that we solve for the axion below the QCD scale. When I perform that Kawa rotation of the quark fields, this is anomalous, and I also generate this term through the electromagnetic anomaly. So even just starting with this term in the UV, I will generate this term in the IR. And the coefficient has to do with the exact values of the masses of the up and down quarks. So if I want to cancel this, I have to add in a UV contribution, which cancels this IR contribution. And so it's tuning. So I can cancel with tuning by adding in a UV contribution, but generically I would expect this term in the IR. So axions are also well-motivated dark matter candidates, but the way we think about axion dark matter is fundamentally different from the way we think about WIMP dark matter. So when we talk about WIMPs, which are very heavy, we talk about these well-separated particles. When we talk about axions, axions are very light, and so the average separation between particles is actually now much smaller than the axion wavelength. And so in this case, it's more appropriate to think of axion dark matter as a dark matter field. We think of a field of dark matter, and we think of the coherent oscillations. It actually, this is non-trivial, but the coherent oscillations of this axion field behave just like cold dark matter for cosmological purposes, making axions, this axion field, a well-motivated dark matter candidate. So there are a variety of ways which you can try to search for axion dark matter. You can try to search for the effects on astrophysics and cosmology. People here are experts in this, for example, super radiance. There are also some ongoing laboratory experiments, such as ADMX and CAS, which I'll mention more on the next slide. But really, today I want to tell you about my new proposal that we just submitted for a new experiment capable of probing axion dark matter. Oh, let me just, okay. Well, you can still see the colors. It's a little funny. I want to first give you a sense for the current constraints on this parameter space. So here on the y-axis, I have this coupling GA gamma gamma in units of inverse GeV of the axion to photons. On the x-axis, I have the axion mass. Now I can convert this mass to frequency, which is what I'm showing you up top. For the QCD axion, the mass is inversely proportional to the axion decay constant, so I can also show you this as FA. And that's what I'm showing you on this inset x-axis, so there are three x-axes. Now, just to orient you, if we focus on the gut scale, that's 10 to the 16 GeV for FA, corresponding to a mass on the order of 10 to the minus 9 EV, and a frequency on the order of a megahertz. So for QCD, GA gamma gamma is inversely proportional to FA, giving me a line through this parameter space, although there is some model dependence which enters into this relationship, which broadens this line into this line into this region. But I can think about more general so-called axion-like particles, which couple to electromagnetism but don't couple to QCD. And this actually opens up the rest of this parameter space because the mass of this particle is now not determined by QCD. So when you look at this plot, you should think that there are dark matter models throughout this entire parameter space, but perhaps the most well-motivated region of parameter space is within this band because this is where the QCD axion is expected to lie. Now, the only very significant constraint in this entire plot is shown up here in this gray band. This is the limit from ADMX, which is a resonant cavity experiment. It looks for axion photon conversion within a resonant cavity. In green, this is the future constraints from ADMX. And in green here, this is a projected constraint from a soon-to-be-running experiment, which looks for axions produced inside of the sun. Now, the main thing that I want you to take away from this plot is that the perhaps most well-motivated region of parameter space, with the k-constants on the order of the gut scale to the string scale to the Planck scale, is really not being probed very well at the moment. And this is where I think we really expect the axion to live, because we have many separate motivations for new physics appearing at these scales. And this is not in danger of being probed by any of the experiments that I've shown here, although, since I'm at perimeter, I should mention black hole superradiance, and this is shaded here, so it's not really showing up. So black hole.
Is this a geography-related statement?
No, it's not a geography-related statement. I'm just trying, no. Anywhere I gave this talk, I would include this slide. But especially here, this is something which you guys know a lot about. Black hole superradiance, or the effect of axions on black holes, is a way of probing this high FA region of parameter space. And there already are some constraints on this region of parameter space, roughly kind of shown in this shaded region, which are kind of encroaching in from the Planck scale. So this is something which is very interesting and one way of getting at this this region of parameter space. But today I'm going to present to you another way.
So I mean, that has nothing to do with the coupling photon, right?
It does at some limit. When this coupling becomes too strong, their constraints actually break down. So they actually need very weak couplings in order to have these constraints.
So the superradiance doesn't happen for a few couplers?
Yeah.
Other than the QCD axiom, if you can imagine, because the QCD axiom has roughly model-independent couplings, if you have the maximum of coupling.
Yeah.
If you have any other axiom, you could have some other self-interaction which would be much larger than the coupling grid of B, right?
That's right.
So in principle, you can just avoid those.
Yeah.
Those are more model-dependent.
Yeah, so now let me turn to my proposal, which is going to get at this region of parameter space around the gut scale.
So can you remind me where Mina's proposal with Andrew Garaki and the previous experiments fall?
It's of the plot.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's over here. Yeah, very, very. So this plot starts at very high FAs. This starts at ADMX.
So this is on the right.
It's on the right, yeah.
Casper
is also getting out of the same region. I can show you a Casper projection afterwards, but it's actually coming also from this. Casper is easier for them to probe very high FA first, so they'll probe the same region first that Mina and collaborators are probing, whereas what I'm going to show you actually goes the other direction. But let me say that after I show you the projections. So key ingredient in this proposal is going to be the axion coupling to photons, this operator which I already showed you. So recall that for axion dark matter, we should be thinking of the axion as some classical background field. And I want to ask, in the presence of a classical background A, how does this term modify Maxwell's equations? So I'm going to take the so-called magnetoquasi-static approximation to Maxwell's equations, which comes down to the approximation that that A is changing on scales which are much larger than the size of my experiment. So this brings me down to magnetoquasi-statics, which means I can ignore electric fields and just think about magnetic fields and currents. So you see that I end up with a very simple modification to Maxwell's equations. There's a new effective current appearing on the right-hand side of Maxwell's equations, which is proportional to GA gamma gamma, this coupling, whatever magnetic field B I already have in my laboratory, and a time derivative of the axion field. Now, the axion field is oscillating in its potential. This is oscillating at the frequency of its mass. I can solve for the normalization by applying the energy density of this field to equal the local dark matter density. And this gives me the following expression for this effective current, which you can see there at the bottom. So now I just want to use this effective current in order to construct a laboratory experiment. So let me imagine a situation where I have an external field B0 which goes in a toroid. So I have a circular B0 field. In the presence of axion dark matter, I end up with an effective current which follows B0. So I have a circular loop of current. And this circular loop of current is going to generate a real magnetic field. And that real magnetic field creates magnetic flux through the center of my toroid. So if I were to put a pickup loop in the middle of this toroid in the absence of axion dark matter, I would see zero magnetic flux through that pickup loop. But in the presence of axion dark matter, I end up with an effective oscillating magnetic field, or sorry, I end up with a real oscillating magnetic field through that pickup loop, which would generate a signal, which would generate a current within that pickup loop.
There was a proposal by Sakibi and about using RC circuits.
Yeah, so this is very closely related to Sakibi's proposal. The geometry is different and the pickup loop is going to be different. But Sakibi was proposing, and Sakibi's proposal is actually based on a proposal by Scott Thomas and collaborators. So the geometry is different in a key way. In particular, they were looking at a cylinder instead of a toroid, and their pickup loop was actually located inside of that cylinder. So even in the absence of axion dark matter, there was already a magnetic field. One very nice aspect of this is that the pickup loop is in an ideally zero field environment, which makes it much easier to work with experimentally. So maybe you believe that there is such a field, but you're probably thinking that it's very small. Indeed, it is a very small effect. So let's try to estimate how small this magnetic field is for QCD axion dark matter at the gut scale. So just to simplify this calculation, let me assume here that all dimensions are equal. So if I look at a cross-section with cross-sectional area, A times H, I'm going to assume that A equals H equals R, where R is the inner radius of this toroid. And I want to estimate the magnetic field at the center of this toroid. So I have an effective current, I effective, circulating through this toroid with magnitude R squared times my current density J effective, which I showed you on the previous slide. And this is just a standard E&M question. So now the magnetic field at the center is proportional to I effective divided by R. And then just using the expression for J effective that I showed you on the previous slide, I end up with the following expression for this magnetic field. Now I can substitute in the numbers, so I take a decay constant on the order of 10 to 16 GeV, a magnetic field in the lab on the order of 5 Tesla, a radius R on the order of 4 meters, and this generates a very small magnetic field on the order of 10 to the minus 23 Tesla, although importantly, this is oscillating at a megahertz at the frequency of the axion mass. And so now what I want to try to convince you is that the current technology is actually the magnetometry technology is to the point where detecting such a small field is not completely unfeasible. So broadly speaking, there are two different types of circuits that I can talk about when I talk about reading out this circuit, reading out this signal. So the first circuit is a resonance circuit and the other is a broadband circuit. Let me start by explaining the resonance circuit. Here this pickup loop is that pickup loop that I showed you in the previous slide in red. And so I'm going to couple that pickup loop into an LC circuit, which is inductively coupled to a squid. And that squid is where the signal is actually measured. So I need to. What I do is I tune the resonant frequency of this LC circuit to match the axion mass. And when I do this, I get resonant enhancement, and it's easier for me to detect this magnetic field. So there are a few problems with this design. One, if I don't know the axion mass ahead of time, I have to keep on tuning the resonant frequency, for example, by tuning a capacitance, in order to scan over a broad range of frequencies. But another more subtle point is that when I have capacitance, capacitors necessarily bring with them some resistance, and that resistance at finite temperature introduces thermal noise. And so in practice, the dominant source of noise in this circuit is thermal noise through the resistance, which is brought in by the capacitor. So the other option is a broadband readout. In the broadband circuit, I couple my pickup loop inductively directly to the squid. In this case, I don't have the resonant enhancement, but I also don't have the thermal noise because I don't have my capacitor. And in this case, the dominant source of noise is actually quantum noise within the squid itself. And so it might not be too surprising that the broadband circuit is better at low frequencies, where I gain more by having less thermal noise than I do than I do essentially gain from this from the resonant enhancement, while the resonance circuit is better at high frequencies, where I gain more from that LC resonance.
Is there also quantum noise in the pickup loop?
So I'm imagining that everything here is superconducting. So there's no thermal noise within this pickup loop, and all other sources of noise.
You might look at zero temperature. There's still a quantum noise.
Yeah. So there is noise within this pickup loop, but it's subdominant compared to the noise within the squid for the regions that I'm going to be considering.
You could have parasitic flux, right?
Yeah. You can have parasitic. That's right.
That's
right. That's right. And at higher frequencies, these are more important. Yeah. So I'm not the first person to point out these circuits or to point out that one is better at low frequencies and one is better at high frequencies. In fact, these readouts are used all the time, for example, in the MRI world to measure very small magnetic fields. And I'm essentially just stealing their designs and applying them for axion dark matter detection. And so with that in mind, let me show you a very quick estimate of what happens if I scale a result which already exists in the literature. So I'm taking a result from a paper by Myers et al. From 2007. They were looking at MRI applications of a broadband magnetometer. And they showed a B-field sensitivity down to 6.4 times 10 to the minus 17 tesla per root hertz. This is the spectral density of magnetic field noise. If you're not used to thinking about signal processing, you should roughly imagine this as the square root of the Fourier transform of B squared. Importantly, their pickup loop had a radius of 3.3 centimeters because they're interested in some biological tissue sample, which had a size of around 3.3 centimeters. For us, we just gain by having a bigger and bigger pickup loop. So what happens if we go to 4 meters? I just want to rescale the sensitivity. Naively, the sensitivity should scale like the flux, which it would scale like R squared. That's not completely correct because also the inductance, the self-inductance of that pickup loop increases as I increase the size of that pickup loop. And so I have to take that into account. And when I do, I find that the sensitivity increases by around 3 orders of magnitude. So if I were to just increase the size of their pickup loop, I would have a field sensitivity on the order of 5 times to the minus 20 tesla per root hertz. Now let's suppose that we have 1 year to run our experiment, and we're interested in a gut scale axion. So I want to ask, what is the smallest field value that I could get down to? In order to answer that question, I need to tell you what the coherence time of the signal is. And to tell you that, I need to tell you I lied to you before when I said that axion oscillates at a frequency equal to its mass. In fact, it oscillates at a frequency equal to its energy. In the first order, the energy equals to the mass. But there are kinetic corrections to this coming from kinetic motion in the axion field. We expect this kinetic motion to have a magnitude on the order of 10 to the minus 3 in natural units. That's just the local virial velocity, giving corrections to the energy on the order of 1/2 mv squared. And then you can see that the coherence time should scale like the mass divided by v squared. Putting in a gut scale mass, I get a coherence time on the order of 10 seconds. So I have a signal at 1 megahertz, which is coherent over 10 seconds, and I have 1 year of interrogation time. And this is my my noise sensitivity.
So what is the frequency that you have in this?
Megahertz for a gut scale. So I want to ask, what's the smallest field that I can get down to? So in order to achieve a signal to noise ratio of 1, if you go through the calculation, and I have a slide explaining this, essentially deriving this relationship later, but just trust me for now, you should take sp to the 1/2, and you should multiply by t tau to the minus 1/4, where t is 1 year and tau is 10 seconds. And if you then multiply the numbers together, you find that I can get down to field sensitivity on the order of 10 to the minus 22 tesla. And this is right around where I showed you we generate fields from axion dark matter at the gut scale. So we're in the right ballpark to be looking for gut scale axion dark matter. So now let me show you projections. So there are two different curves here. The blue curve assumes a radius of 1 meter. The dotted curve assumes a radius of 4 meters. This is for the broadband readout strategy. Importantly, I need to be at a temperature less than 60 millikelvin because that's the temperature that I need in order to not have thermal noise within the squid itself being the dominant source of noise.
So that means if you have 40 meters, R equal to 40 meters can draw out of the region.
Sorry?
If you have R equal to 40 meters, you're sensitive to all the region.
Yeah, so if we can have R equals 40 meters, that would be really nice.
You need to cool it to us.
Yeah, so. Yeah, no, I mean, it's good to think big, right? So bigger the better here.
What is the biggest, actually? What is the biggest dilution refrigerator ever?
I don't know. The biggest ones that you can buy just off the shelf,
yeah.
I think, are on the order of a meter cubed volume.
Even the 4 meter thing, so it
yeah.
Maybe
this requires
1,000 times bigger.
That's right. So the 4 meters would require something probably specialty made. Actually, there are specialty made refrigerators which get down to the relevant temperatures which would fit this inside of it. Then you need to rescale these plots roughly by the square root of the temperature divided by 60 millikelvin, I think.
Yeah.
is how it will scale.
60 milkelvin or 600 milkelvin?
Sorry, 600 milkelvin. Yeah.
So you don't have to pull.
Yeah. You could have it up higher temperatures. That's right. That's right. You'd still probably gain by volume, but yeah.
And then you can do it much easier.
Yeah.
That is for, well, yes, but the dam, the pull down the entire panel of the LH.
Right.
So there's less than there, right? So you don't have to worry about whether or not I have to.
Right.
Yeah, it's bankrupt my budget by having to build the dilution
generator as big as the roof. No, so I think this is the right way to be thinking for the future. I mean, the bigger, the more volume, the better. So some points to take away from this. And by the way, I was considering 1 year of interrogation time in a 5 Tesla maximum magnetic field. Some points to take away is that we do probe the axion dark matter regime in a very interesting range of FA around the gut scale. And this is the range which is hard to get to with these other approaches, either up here or down here with, say, super radiance. This is what I would get from a resonant design instead of a broadband circuit. Now I have to actually specify the exact temperature why do I have to specify the temperature? Because in this case, the dominant source of noise is thermal noise within that resistor. And so for any temperature, just the lower temperature, the better. And so here I'm assuming a temperature of 0.1K. I'm assuming I can achieve a quality factor of 10 to the 6 over this entire frequency range, which may be very hard to do in practice with a single experiment. And moreover, I'm assuming I tuned that frequency over that 1 year of time from a few hundred megahertz down to a hertz.
So here you assume that you scan this entire range within a year.
Within a year.
So you fix your duty cycle, let's say, by the,
that's right,
the coherence time or whatever it takes to run the
operation. Exactly, yeah.
And it's still the 1 in 4 meters.
And it's still the 1 in 4 meters for the solid and for the dotted. So clearly this isn't the strategy which you would really want to do in practice. I think the strategy I would advocate for is to first do a broadband run in some sense, and then to do follow-up surveys with a resonant design, just sitting at frequencies where you might have seen something with the broadband or where you might have a good theory prior ahead of time.
Do you actually purpose the same experiment? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, no. This is all at the level of the readout. So this is something which is plugged in to the leads which are coming out of your. So it would be very simple
so
to change.
Pickup
loop is the same. It's just adding in a capacitor essentially. So that would be very simple to switch back and forth between these. So just one other point. Notice that I've stopped these curves at some high mass, and the reason is, as I go to higher and higher mass, my wavelength becomes smaller and smaller, and eventually it starts to become smaller than the size of my experiment, and then my magnetoquasi-static approximation breaks down. Indeed, ADMX works in this limit where the wavelength equals the size of the cavity, which is on the order of 10 centimeters. So you can see that I'm fundamentally in a different limit. I'm in the limit where the wavelength is much larger than the size of the cavity, so I think these two approaches are very complementary in that sense. So what do I think are the most important things to do now? One, most importantly, I think, is to demonstrate a prototype, demonstrate that this works. And I'll tell you a little bit more before concluding on the next slide. But just more generally, I think that axions and light bosonic dark matter, this is very exciting to be looking for these. One, because axions are very well motivated, as I showed from the strong CP problem, but also very well motivated by thinking about high-scale physics, turning that around. Detecting axion dark matter, light bosonic dark matter, may provide a direct window into physics at high scales, for example, the gut scale, the string scale, the inflationary scale. So as someone who also spends some time thinking about string theory, I find this very attractive. And I think this really motivates broadly thinking about new ideas to search for ultralight scalars, dark photons, and so forth. So now, to conclude, let me just show you two slides, on a prototype which we're trying to build now at MIT. So this is going to be in conjunction with many people at MIT, also Princeton and Stanford. And so here is an image of what we're trying to build. We're trying to build a prototype which is going to be 12 centimeters by 12 centimeters. So for some scale, my hand is 16 centimeters. So this would fit into the palm of your hand. This is a very small experiment. Here you can see these coils source that magnetic field. The main B field is shown in blue. And then the pickup loop is actually a superconducting sheath which surrounds this entire toroid. And then the leads coming out of that pickup loop would go into the squid. So we're trying to achieve a magnetic field of 1 tesla. And here's the sensitivity that we think we can achieve, shown in blue. And this is a resonant search, which would be centered directly around the gut scale. Yeah?
What causes
that? This is 1/f noise, which kicks into your squid. So the squid has a flat spectral noise profile at high frequencies, but at low frequencies, it's so-called 1/f noise, which kicks in here around 50 hertz, I believe. So we want to demonstrate this, which would itself probe an interesting region of ALP dark matter parameter space. But I think more importantly, this would be a proof of principle. We can do this just with internal funding at MIT, which is what we're trying to do. Timescale here is hopefully on the order of a year, and then try to build a bigger experiment to actually get down to the QCD axion. Questions? You're expecting a more subtle. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Well, you have to wait. Come back next year for the rest.
So the proposal, how many orders of magnitude of physics from what you guys have in the paper?
Okay, so it's going to be, this is... Yeah, so
there,
here in blue...
19, let's say for the, it's, like, 4 orders of magnitude.
That's 10 to the minus 15 at 10 to the minus 6 EV.
No, I want to compare the best.
Oh, the best?
Yeah.
Okay, so the best is going to be at around 10 to the minus 17.
Yeah.
And the best is around 10 to the minus 13. So yeah, many orders of magnitude. And you can understand this because we've rescaled here. So 12 centimeters corresponds to an R of 3 centimeters. And so we want to rescale this by around a factor of 100. So that's, and now our signal scale is like volume. So that's 10 squared cubed. That's 10 to the sixth. And then we lose roughly an order of magnitude from self-inductance, which gets you down to around 10 to the 5. So if you can make this thing bigger the better, because your signal scale is like volume.
As long as you don't find any new sources
of noise. As long as you don't find any new sources of noise. That's right, although so your noise doesn't, your noise sensitivity won't scale like 10 to the 5. It'll scale slightly better than that, because as you make the thing bigger, you're also inducing a stronger response magnetic field.
Wouldn't you pick up any strays much easier, right?
Well, no, you do pick up strays, but I think at the end of the day, your noise sensitivity roughly scales like R squared. So as you increase the size of your experiment, your signal will increase like R cubed, roughly, ignoring the self-inductance. But your noise requirements will become stronger by R squared.
From screening and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
The could be noise from the loop itself, but
from the what itself?
From fluxes in the loop itself.
Yes.
Because
yes.
It's a big area, right?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that this is an easy thing to achieve, which is why we're trying to go through this in stages.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you make this bigger, I think there are going to be a whole host of other problems which will come in. Even just keeping vibrationally separated and everything. But
I have one question. So can you explain that coherence time of 10 seconds? Or
yeah, so the energy is the mass plus 1/2 mv squared.
Okay.
And what's v? V is the local virial velocity.
Right.
And so this is going to be the shift in frequency that we expect away from just the mass. And the coherence time is what is essentially the drift. We can understand is what is the drift in frequency. And so I just want to know what time scale does that 1/2 mv squared correspond to?
It's a random velocity, so there's not one.
Yeah, that's right. So the way you should think about this velocity is if I sit here right now and I measure velocity in the axion field, I will measure one direction. Now let me wait past the coherence time and measure the direction again, and I'll get a different direction. So every coherence time, the direction is changing. And if I were to measure this direction enough, I would reconstruct the velocity distribution that we expect for cold dark matter, which should look roughly like some boosted Gaussian. So I'd essentially reconstruct the standard halo model. But at any instance of time, I would see one velocity in this field. Any other questions?
Let's think that again.